I'm just going to be brief and tie up a few loose ends from last time. All right, but I also want to call attention to three books that have a large overlap in some ways in dealing with the same topic, because it involves three related topics. Now, last time I ended by talking a little bit about the theme of the apocalypse and David and Bethia's book, The Shape of Apocalypse in Modern Russian Fiction, which deals with more than Dostoevsky. In fact, it's after a very long introduction of some 60 pages, he has a 40-page chapter on the idiot that's very interesting. And you know, of course, that the apocalypse, or that is John's book of Revelations, John the Apostle, figures rather prominently in this. Lebedev associates the coming of the railway with an apocalyptic event at one point. And the iron horse becomes like the four horses of the apocalypse. That is, they seem to be impelling Russia towards some sort of climax in the future. I'm not going to say very much more about this in connection with the idiot, at least not now. We'll talk about this in more detail when we get to Dostoevsky's next novel. What I do want to call attention to is two other books. One is Sarah Young. Oh, by the way, we don't seem to have a copy of this in the library. So if you're absolutely desperate, I could always put the chapter on the idiot on Blackboard for you. Sarah Young, Dostoevsky's Idiot and the Ethical Foundations of Narrative, which bears a subtitle, Reading, Narrating, Scripting, and William J. Leatherbarrow's A Devil's Vaudeville, the Demonic in Dostoevsky's Major Fiction. Now, what all three of these books have in common is they notice something very interesting, and one of the reasons for giving this little quiz is to bring some of this out. The characters in this novel are constantly scripting one another. They're constantly trying to read one another's minds or characters, or to reveal something within them. And Mishkin does this himself rather conspicuously, beginning, of course, with Nastasya. But it is pervasive. It runs throughout this novel. If you find this novel peculiar and difficult and strangely constructed, I think there's a reason for it. It's because throughout this novel, people are constantly trying to impose their views of what people are on those very people. Now, as it happens, there are two passages very close together in which all of this is also connected up with what we've been calling the technique of the realistic novel. So if you will, look in your text on page 469, if you have the Garnett translation published by,
Modern Library.
Oh, this is Modern Library, yeah. So it's on page 469. I am using the PVR Volokhonsky translation. I reread this book in four different translations this time around, just to see. And at least in the broader aspects, they all are about the same, although when you get down to detail, they're different. So page 469. Now here, Aglaya is talking to Mishkin, and she's talking about Ganya, and she says she loves Ganya and that he loves her. And she says, he burned his hand in front of me just to prove that he loves me more than life itself. Have you found that? All right, and now something very amusing follows here. You know, there's so many people in this novel who are constantly grandstanding. We get it with Hippolyte, for instance. We get it with Rogozhin. And to some extent, we get it with Mishkin, as reticent as he might seem. Anyway, why did he bring a candle with him? Now listen to this carefully, because there's more going on here than you imagine. What? Did he bring a candle here with him? If it happened here. Otherwise, I can't imagine. Yes, a candle. What's so incredible? Whole or in a candlestick? These are novelistic details, you notice. And Mishkin is asking for details. Why? Because the story doesn't seem very likely. And so he asked about details to nail it down better. No, half a candle, a candle in, a whole candle. It's all the same, leave me alone. And he brought matches, if you like. Fill in the details. He lit the candle and held his finger over the flame for a whole half hour. Can't that be?
I don't think so.
Yeah. I saw him yesterday. There was nothing wrong with his fingers. Aglaya suddenly burst out laughing, just like a child. You know why I lied to you just now? She suddenly turned to the prince with the most childlike trustfulness, with laughter still trembling on her lips. Because when you lie, if you skillfully put in something not quite usual, something eccentric, well, you know, something that happens quite rarely or even never, the lie becomes much more believable. I've noticed that. Only with me it came out badly because I wasn't able to. Notice how much there is of the elliptical in this novel. How people stop in the middle of a sentence. They leave out things. They expect it to be filled in. It's as though these characters open themselves up to having their own scripts written by other people. But it goes beyond that. We realize that this whole society is scripted in one way or another. You know, we go all the way back to Peter the Great, who scripted the Russian future by creating St. Petersburg, or Petersburg, not St. Petersburg, by creating a city that was based on a whole plot and a plan for the future. And this ties in with this whole apocalyptic vision, because the apocalypse is a revealed script for the future. It tells us what's going to happen to us at the end of time, when the whole story of God's plan for the world is played out, and when the Antichrist comes, and when the second coming occurs. And Dostoevsky realized perfectly well that this second coming then had to be the end of life as we know it, totally. If we're all taken up into a perfect life and a perfect existence, we're not in this world anymore. And so at this point, the transition moment becomes the death of this world as we know it and the death of ourselves as we know ourselves. That is, our imperfect, our ignorant selves, ignorant of the future, but also ignorant of our own personalities, our own inner motives, all of this. So this is part of this scripting that's going on. And yet, at the same time, if you're writing a novel, you make things seem realistic by putting something in that doesn't fit the script somehow. Now, if you turn over just a few more pages to page 483, we get Lebedev, who's complaining that he's missing 400 rubles. They were in a billfold, and he put them in his jacket, and then when he went back, they weren't in his jacket anymore. And he goes through a series of scripts to figure out who is the most plausible thief among them. And they're analyzing character, they're analyzing motives and all of this. And so finally he comes to Ferdushchenko, and he says, must have been Ferdushchenko. Mishkin says, and notice it's Mishkin again, who's being told these stories that have a limited range of plausibility. Well, who else? Naturally, who else? That is, once again, what evidence is there? There is evidence, sir. First of all, his disappearance is 7 o'clock, or even before 7 o'clock in the morning. I know, Kolya told me he came and said he was going to spend the rest of the night at, I forget whose place, some friend's.
Vilkin, sir.
So Nikolai Ardalionovich told you already. He didn't say anything about the theft. Now, what do we know about the general? He's a consistent liar, isn't he? You remember the story about the dog being tossed out the window? So, wait, I've heard that story. That was in the papers 2 weeks ago. That didn't happen to you. Such that here's the general scripting himself by stealing from a newspaper article. And he makes up stories right and left about Napoleon, you know, and so on and so forth. So can you trust him? And so immediately we begin to think, well, he's in need of money. Is it more likely that he stole the 400 rubles? Yeah, I would think so. He's got his mistress that he's still trying to satisfy by paying. So he didn't say anything about the theft. He doesn't know, for I've so far kept the matter a secret. And so he goes to Vilkin. Now we're back to Fedushchenko. So he goes to Vilkin. You might think, what's so puzzling about a drunk man going to see another drunk man just like himself, even though it's the wee hours of the morning and without any reason at all, sir? So this, again, we're back into the realm of realism and speculation about what is realistic and what is not. What makes sense, what does not. But it's here that the trail begins. On his way up, he leaves the address. Now, follow the question, Prince. Why did he leave the address? Why does he purposely go to Nikolai Ardalionovich? Kind of hard to pronounce, isn't it? That Lyon always gets a stress in Russian. Ardalionovich, making a detour, sir, and telling, I'm going to spend the rest of the night at Vilkin. And who is interested in his leaving and going precisely to Vilkin's? Why announce it? No, there's a subtlety here, a thievish subtlety. It means, look here, I'm not concealing my tracks. What kind of thief am I after that? Would a thief announce where he's going? So, Lebedev says, well, it's pretty clear that he's covering his tracks here because a thief wouldn't tell you where he's going, so you could track him. So he goes, and he sends the general, and the general goes, and guess what? He hasn't come. But then there's another explanation. He came, as a matter of fact, 2 hours earlier, and they wouldn't, the butler, the housemaid, wouldn't let him in. And so finally he left and never saw Vilkin. So what you get here is this reliability and unreliability of all these stories. And this has to cast some doubt in our minds about what people are saying about other people. And we realize that these scripts, as it were, also determine whole social classes. That is, in the village, Marie is scripted by the villagers who reject her, and by the priest, or the pastor, who preaches about her wickedness at her mother's funeral, and so on. All of these are people who are cast in certain roles that are part of scripts that other people have imagined. But then, the whole point about the script is that it has to be realistic. See, it has to be something that you will believe, because somehow it makes sense fictionally, narratively, even though reality, very often, events don't necessarily follow the script. And the large script then that's going on in the background of this story, you might call it the script of scripts, has to do with two parallel apocalypses. Russia, which will bring back the true Christ to the world, unlike the Antichrist, which is, among other things, Switzerland, the Roman Catholic Church, so on and so forth, or the other Antichrist, which is the new revolutionary movement radical socialism and the mechanization and materialism that threatened to take over the world as well. And we know which one of these occurred.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, what were you saying about them seeing the Roman Catholic Church as an Antichrist?
Oh, yeah, this
or
is...
Dostoevsky
yeah, this,
did.
Oh, you'll the Russians it. Did generally.
Oh.
You'll read it.
You'll get it. Don't worry, it'll come.
But Roman Catholicism is so close to Orthodoxy. It's like...
The closer things get, the more problems there are, the more friction there is between them,
yes.
Believe me. Okay, I'm going to stop there and let Dr. Cowan continue.
Well, I'm sorry you have to put up with all this hemming and hawing and old man sound that is coming out of me. I'm as impatient with it as you are, believe me. But I'm glad Scott has been dwelling on some of these central techniques of Dostoevsky. They're so important, and it's important to revive our sense of why Dostoevsky was considered a genius, because he was, you know. And for many years, especially in the early years of the 20th century, he was regarded as the great teacher of Nietzsche, you know, of Freud, of Jung. All believed they could get enormous insight. They would often say, the more atheist of them would say, well, everything that he believes is utter hogwash, but his insight into the human psyche, right, into the human mind, is enormously profound. And Einstein once said that he learned more from Dostoevsky than from any philosopher. So he was, in fact, one of the great minds. His fortunes have fallen from those days. But after Bakhtin, a new regard for him has sprung up for the power of his technique and, in a sense, the kind of the vision that shines through that technique, an insight into the complexity of this world, into just exactly what you sign on for when you accept this world as it really is. And through that, I think we are able to get illuminated a new side of Dostoevsky's greatness. The old side is still one worth visiting and looking at, because Dostoevsky's profoundness, his profundity, is indeed formidable. But we are still discovering new facets of him, and I think that's very exciting. What's really exciting, of course, sorry, I'm working also not only with all this junk, I mean, but I had a traumatic experience of listening to my own lecture on the MP3 and then realizing, you know, who is that Fort Worth cowboy up there trying to sound like an intellectual? So I may try and sound louder or softer. Let me know if I'm inaudible in the back rows, but I don't know. Somehow I don't think coming to the University of Dallas from far away is the best way to get rid of that accent, so I may just have to accept it. Okay. The Idiot, I mean, the novel itself is the great experience, and I'm hoping that you have finished the whole thing by now. If not, you know, we condescend to wait until Tuesday to quiz you. But what you will have experienced in terms of its impact on you, in other words, like how you receive that novel in your pulse, you know, the first part is an absolute, well, it begins on a train, and it is it's a train wreck. I mean, the thing comes into the station with enormous momentum and doesn't quit until the last word has been said of part one. A magnificent and terrifying performance. It then slacks off for parts two and three. And sometimes we may be wondering, you know, what has Dostoevsky done? Has he lost his hold? So much else is being introduced into the novel. It was very much focused on Mishkin and on Nastasya Filipovna. And now it wanders around, and we create an enormous cast of characters. We get into the Yepanchin family with detail. We get into the Lebedevs, the Ivolgins. That whole gang of street trash that came in is all there. We get them fleshed out. Hippolyte has his day, and what a day it is. And another aspect then that happens is there will be characters who suddenly take long monologues and are going on and on, you know. And so we are, and sometimes it seems almost a violation that you've gotten to Hippolyte's speech, the confession, as he comes to call it, or the explanation, as he starts out by calling it. Two parallel things are going on. I mean, it's itself an enigmatic and marvelous performance, and we must look at it in detail perhaps next time. But how are we responding to it? I myself am really put out that it doesn't stop at the end of the chapter, but goes on entirely through the next chapter and part of the next chapter, right? I'm a little put out by this. But then I see that very reaction in Hippolyte's audience. And I say, they are terrible. They have hearts of stone to act that way. But of course, usually the reader doesn't reflect and say, well, I was that way too. What is going on? Obviously, it's not unintentional. Dostoevsky has these effects and is as you say, scripting or engineering these effects as part of his art, which he does not see as a Renaissance painter might see art, you know, but as something designed to reveal the complexity and the depth of human life to people whose condition we are, as our species is not to know ourselves. So it's magnificent stuff. I will tell you, the fourth part, towards the end, again, gains that pile driver momentum, and you will make sure that when you start the last 80 pages, you know, you're not in anything that has to be interrupted, because it will knock you out if you haven't already gotten there. But by the time you finish, whether you finish now or whether you're halfway through, we're facing the same problem. What is the meaning of this novel? It is so complex, and with so many, it goes out in so many directions. It is daunting in that way. We would like to hold on to the title character and say it's all about him, but he himself is a mystery. And Dostoevsky's enigmatic prince is something we must certainly decide what he means, or what he is, who he is, decide something crucial about his character. But beyond that, we have to ask, you know, what is the meaning, what is the intention of Dostoevsky's novel? You know, what a serious author has in mind with his work may not be articulable in any other way except by the work itself. And what does this work intend is our more intelligent question than what did Dostoevsky mean to say with Mishkin. What does the work intend is similar to asking the old-fashioned question, you know, what did the muse want? What was the vision of the author? There is a depth there that is implied that cannot be stated as an intent. A novel is not a speech act, and a novel is not an essay or an argument. It is, with Dostoevsky, certainly an exploration. So, as Dr. Dupree has mentioned, critics are beginning to come around to a more complex view of Mishkin, because I think that, I'm not sure, but it seems to me that if you go with the idea that Mishkin is Dostoevsky's exploration of what Christ would be like if he came back to the 19th century, or that he's in some way, shape, or form a Christ figure in a fallen world. That gives me problems because the original Christ figure was a Christ figure in a fallen world. But if you hold that view, then it seems hard not to say that the novel itself is somehow also a kind of failed experiment, that he didn't really quite have hold of his material. I don't know. I may be wrong in that. But we do want to ask, as we do always with important works of art, what is the action of this work? This does not require us to be the card-carrying Chicago Aristotelians, but it's to think of the question of the action of a work is at once to attempt in your mind to grasp its entire form. What is the central action that goes through the work? Right? And think about the opening of the novel. This is actually something that Yevgeny Pavlovich Radomsky, otherwise known as Radomsky, goes into in his last speech in the entire book. The strange coincidence of that beginning that determined, Radomsky says, everything for Mishkin. I think that's a little bit of an over-interpretation, but the importance of that beginning, that we have these two strangers coming into not just any city, but a city we know well, Petersburg. Right. Mysterious, timely arrival of Mishkin. Can you think of that as, does Petersburg need something at this point? What is it getting when it gets Mishkin? And Mishkin has to be suddenly, by chance, it seems, accompanied with his shadowy opposite, Rogozhin. These two enter Petersburg. Their lives and the lives of everyone, are changed. Along with them, the loquacious chatterer, Lebedev. There are a 19th century equivalent of Twitter. Never stops, and annoys even Mishkin, right? And what we know of Petersburg and Petersburg's version of Russia itself is that it's a world in crisis, if that's fair to say. The heat is turned up from what the vision that we've already seen implicit early in Gogol's Dead Souls, in Turgenev's Fathers and Sons. It's far advanced from that. The world that Dostoevsky is describing is a contemporary world for him. The serfs have been freed. Many changes are in the offing in Russia. And the intelligentsia have taken the center stage and are dictating what the life of the mind is to be and what the laws ought to be. So into this strange world of crisis arrives something. And then we have to deal with the perennial presence of Nastasya Filippovna. Right? Because she soon, any time that she appears, the scene, she becomes the focus. And everyone reacts to her. She is the object of desire, but she is at the same time, we have, of course, a strong sense of her violation. She has been violated. She is proud. And yet she harbors a deep sense of guilt and shame, suffers for this, and the intense responses that come from people on this tell us, again, something about this social and religious crisis in Russia. The very form of crisis seems to come about through the arrival first of Mishkin and then the arrival of Nastasya Filippovna. Western influence growing more dominant in this time. Russia is changing, and so that it is no longer truly an agrarian society, but one that is quickly joining the community of capitalist societies. It is no longer itself. And this is Gogol's point, for all the way from the nose to Dead Souls and so forth. There's been that term, I hope I haven't scribbled this on the board before, but, and again, this is not our top rank French intellectual, but an interesting writer nonetheless, Jean Baudrillard, who in several essays of his writes about the simulacrum. And it seems to me that Dostoevsky, like Gogol, is concerned about the simulacrum. The simulacrum is a copy of a copy. It's lost the original, the experience has been lost, and the meme, the motif, whatever we want to call it, simply bounces from carrier to carrier. In that sense, and Baudrillard's great theme that he kept harping on, he now did, is that we lose our humanity that way. We lose any direct relation to reality. The simulacra become things that interpose themselves between us and anything real. And we see that over and over in the scripts that Dr. Dupree is just talking about, and in the false behavior that our great novelists have displayed in their novels. This was a time then, if Western ideas coming in, that secular goodness began to become the ideal, right? An ideal infused with the sentimentalism of the Romantic era, and Romanticism, of course, as a movement in general, is one that tries to compensate for or to recover the lost wholeness of the world that, as we think back in our thumbnail history of the world, was lost during all the schisms and revolutions that took place from the 15th century on in the West. But Romanticism tried to do this within subjectivity, right? And so within the individual subject. So it often found its center in emotion and sentimentality. And it was none other than Rousseau. And I believe, Dr. Dupree, you've talked about this, have you?
Very, very marginally.
Okay. Rousseau, who said that one of the great impulses of our being is compassion, right? Or la pitié. Nietzsche responded to this and criticized this. He said compassion was the opposite of a virtue in the classical age. Nietzsche's ideal was always the classical age, but sometimes that's a quite salutary thing to remember. It was that same fear that Aristotle talked about that is raised in tragedy and that has to be expelled by catharsis. Because it's a danger. Pity and fear. Pity and fear are a danger to the polis and have to be expelled. We're a little alien to that today. We're totally alien to that today. But it's good to remember why that is. Because compassion is a feeling, is not a virtue. Unless you're following Jean-Jacques, right, who hails from Geneva. So his presence in this novel is a shadowy and never mentioned one, but an important one. Goodness becomes defined in terms of sentiment and feeling. So we've seen, again, with Gogol, the false take the place of the true in Poshlost, and in Turgenev, in Bazarov's convictions, the loss of the old holy Russia. And Dostoevsky is similarly concerned in the idiot, in the artist, if he is a true artist, and what is marks the greatness of the Russian novel as a body of work is that the artist at his best warns the community about what is in its own heart, warns his readers of what's happening in our world. Joseph Collingwood wrote that the secrets that the poet utters are not his own, but those of the community. So that's important. I do wish more poets would read that. But whether they do or not, the great ones somehow know this. Not his own, but those of the community. Because no community knows its own heart. It has to be told where its heart lies. So I think if we look at it in that way, we see, you know, we begin to try to embrace the wholeness of this novel and not be saying, you know, when is Mishkin going to get back on stage? When are we going to have a good fight with Rogozhin and so forth? Because in some ways it's frustrating this way. Now remember that The Idiot was the hardest of Dostoevsky's novels to write, and he wrote some much longer ones. This one was written in Geneva, in Milan, in Florence. It was written away from Russia. It was written amid poverty and suffering, trauma, the loss of his firstborn son, despair. It was started the year after Crime and Punishment was finished and he was married. And two paintings were tremendously influential. You mentioned one of these and shown them, and I heard there was a gasp. But one of them is Claude Lorrain's poem, painting, I'm sorry, about the Golden Age. Axis and Galatea. This is one that impressed Dostoevsky terribly. And it's about the Golden Age, a depiction of the Golden Age. Dostoevsky thought that the Golden Age was the most pernicious idea, the most dangerous idea ever unleashed on mankind. That will no doubt surprise you. The Golden Age is also the subject of a good part of discussion in Don Quixote. But the Golden Age is a lure, in Dostoevsky's view, away from our true reality, our acceptance of ourselves, and a wish to make our simple beliefs in the good rule everything. It begins as a dream of freedom from, right, all the various limiting conditions that keep us from our happiness, and ends by the imposition of these things as incarnated, as various twisted incarnations. Well, the other picture is one that you saw, and that's the Holbein picture of the dead Christ, which receives a magnificent exegesis from Hippolyte in his little treatise. And you can see in that the threat of materialism envisioned as not just as an idea, as an ideology, but as an atmosphere in which everything takes place. It's a profound thing, and it's hard really to state what that must have. It'd be impossible to state what that must have caused in Dostoevsky's mind, in the attestation of his wife. She found him in a catatonic state looking at this painting at the museum and feared that he was going to have an epileptic fit in front of it, and gently moved him away from it, and the moment passed, but he was there for a long, long time staring at the painting, and it was of great influence on him.
He even stood on a chair, and she said she was afraid they were going to come and arrest him. And today he would have set off an alarm. But
yeah, no kidding. So we know Dostoevsky had been reading Don Quixote, and that then was, as Faulkner says, part of the wood in his lumber room. That is to say, you know, one doesn't do a novel as a direct parody or as an adaptation of another novel. One may, if one likes, enter into a kind of dialogue with the previous work, but as an artist, one is completely free to disassemble all the parts, chop them up, and put them in a different way in your own novel. And this, I think, is perhaps a little more descriptive of what Dostoevsky has done with Don Quixote, because who in their right mind would try to claim that Rogozhin is Sancho Panza? You know? And yet you see a vague, dark resemblance between that pair and Quixote and Panza. So he's doing his own thing. There's no question about it. Dostoevsky was also reading about abused children. There was a terrible account of a certain case in Petersburg at that time. So all of this became grist for his mill, and he was the first novelist to deal with the sexual abuse of a child. Censors actually didn't want to allow that aspect into the novel, but it did. It made it through anyway. Of course, he handles it with great dignity, with, I want to say, with compassion, and I think that's appropriate. Totsky, you know, the protector, who should have been the protector of Nastasya Filippovna, has used her in the most shameful way and has made her feel complicit in it. Right, so this is a terrible crime for which Totsky is not held accountable by that society. But how it has its effect on Nastasya Filippovna is crucial for her character. She is always proud, defiant, lashing out, if at anyone, always at Totsky or a substitute for him. She doesn't want to admit her guilt or any inferiority that she might have to anyone. But at the same time, she always carries that guilt with her.
I'm just wondering, would it not have been possible to nail Totsky for statutory rape and landed in prison, or is it just that Nastasya doesn't even want to go there? Like, was this considered a crime, even, that you could go to prison for in Russia?
Oh.
Because she was, what, 16, and he's 40? That's kind of perverse. Mm. Or it's just very perverse, more than kind of.
It is perverse.
And was this not illegal?
Yeah, you know, you're asking the wrong guy here. But you know, I think my impression is that the statutory book has been enormously expanded in the 20th century. But yeah.
Yeah, you're thinking 21st century. This is the 19th.
Got a question, comment?
Are we sure their relationship was that sexual or that sexual for that long? Or
I marked it on I marked page 75 or something like that. I forget where it is. But there's proof. It's quickly passed over. But I think it's where she says that she will accept a payment for him, from him, not as, what does she say? Not as payment, but as compensation for the wrongs done to her. Right. Yeah.
You said that this is the first, he's the first novelist to deal with this.
Am I wrong?
Well, I was just asking, is he the first Russian novelist? Because Johnson writes a letter in his, it's in the Rambler. That's the prostitute story, and it's pretty much the exact same story, except, and he's writing, you know, from the perspective of the prostitute, so it's...
Okay, I think I may have to take
explicit,
that back,
so
because
well,
I'm wondering
if...
But that's not fiction.
Yeah.
Right, so I was
yeah.
asking, like, if this is really the first time it's ever appeared in fiction, or...
Yeah, I think it is, actually, but think about where these come from. They come from newspapers.
Yeah.
And the newspapers started recording this story. In the late 18th century, but this is too sensational to put into a novel until we get this turn to realism,
mm-hmm.
and fantastic realism.
You were exploring that relation that
yeah.
the English novels went into,
mm-hmm.
you know, with Richardson and everyone. All right, so, but you see, she carries that guilt with her anyway. She wants to be in touch with it. And that is why we have the perverse, the particular perversity of Nastasya, the desire to hurt herself, desire to throw herself into the abyss, right? Because she knows she deserves punishment. On the one hand, she wants to hear Mishkin's message. She finds it enormously attractive. You're not to blame. You're not to blame for anything. But at the last moment, always, she can't bear the idea. It's not just that she rejects it and says, oh, it's false. But she can't bear the idea, and she throws herself into Rogozhin as into an abyss. because she would rather that than the affirmation that Mishkin is giving her. Why is that, Patrick?
What about also the idea that she's taking revenge of a sort on Kotsky?
That too, certainly. Yeah, but yeah, it seems that that would overcome it if she could believe what the prince is telling her. So, but if she's not to blame, you know, then it seems as though it's as though her conscience is no longer alive. It is no longer to be listened to. There is no conscience. Her conscience is a different matter. Conscience is a matter of your feelings. And I think she's terrified more by that unreality that she associates with Mishkin. And that makes her suddenly turn in the opposite direction.
Also, it means she's powerless.
Mm.
Sure. She's not the kind of person who wants to live of a life of a victim.
Mm-hmm. No, I try. Yes.
Kind of following up for that, I was a little bit struck by that phrase, you're not to blame, as in it seemed almost in some shade false to me. Because it implies that she does have no choice in the matter. It's what happens is what happens, and she will be a victim no matter what. And I almost found it with a shade of an insult almost to her. So I wonder if that plays into her kind of distant, not going with it as much as she.
Absolutely, I think so. I think you hit the nail on the head, perhaps better than I was doing. So I mean, it's you know, obviously, she's a profoundly enigmatic character, but I think behind her is certainly that bruise, that damage that she has had early on, and that has now become, you know, one with her whole character. So now we really have to ask, then what do we call the action of this novel? I've been dancing around this question. And we could say, if you like, that it's the effort of Mishkin to become fully human, to incarnate himself. That seems a tempting option, but I think it leaves out too much. Because I think Mishkin, although he's the title character, although he begins and ends the novel, is only part of the equation. At the center of the central action always is Nastasya Filipovna. Although she, throughout the novel, she will come in and then go out, and she's like a rumor for a long time, and then suddenly she appears and there's a commotion. Whenever she does appear, there's a terrible commotion. Because the central action, I think, tying together the novel, is to find Nastasya Filipovna a bridegroom. Remember that Totski has been wanting to marry her off, get her off his hands, so that he could marry a respectable wife. He's reached the fully empowered age of 55, and wants to do something with his life and to get rid of this burden. And so the problem for the novel becomes to find a bridegroom for Nastasya Filipovna. And if we begin to look for an archetypal action in this novel, it seems to come down to that magnetism of the desire for a hieros gamos, the desire for a sacred marriage, right, that will, you know, renew and redeem the society that is in crisis. The train is coming into the station in Petersburg, and it's doing it because this is a decisive moment. This is the moment of the kairos, right? The moment of fullness. It means ripeness, harvest time in Greek. It is the decisive time. And so something is meant to happen. But we have to look then at all the damages that have occurred to this possibility. If Nastasya Filipovna is hurt and violated, and as his early novel titled it, insulted and injured, that is, she is, of course, in the very soul of Russia itself. She is Mother Russia, that is so loved, and so whose love has gotten lost. And if she's meant to have a bridegroom, she instead seems to have two at the least, more actually, that want to be qualified. But it always comes down to a 180-degree choice for her. So the bridegroom is not a hero. He is split into two characters. Right. And we can easily allegorize them as mind and body because of the way that Dostoevsky paints them in such opposite characteristics. But the central fact is that the hero has been split in our modern world, right? And the mind is no longer in communication with the body.
Did you say that The Idiot is the same book as The Insulted and the Injured?
Oh, no.
Okay, I was going to say,
No, that was an early novel.
Okay.
And I said, Nastasya, I said it's a handy phrase for describing an aspect of Nastasya, of Natasha, that she is insulted and injured. So, and you remember that Rogozhin, when he first sees her, he says, "I fell all in a heap." Right, his reaction is physical, it's immediate. And Mishkin first sees a picture of her, her portrait, and discerns in that portrait great suffering. And we hear him over and over in the novel saying, "I fell in love with that suffering. I fell in love with her, but I also feared her because of it."
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know if this would detract from the direction you're going in, but I was wondering about Aglaya's relation to Nastasya, and because Aglaya also has this kind of finding a bridegroom sense,
yes,
about her.
Right.
Is she parallel to Nastasya and shares in that central, or is she meant to abuse some kind of foil in some degree, or?
I think it's a very good question. Of course, we're teased by that strange parallelism between Aglaya and then the ultimate opposition, the ultimate clash between them. But I don't think that they're meant to be mirror images of each other, or one is a false copy of the other, or simulacra of each other. I think they play different roles. Because if we look at Nastasya, she is outcast from the beginning. If you go back and read her early story, it's quite fascinating. She really is the soul of Russia, because she comes from the land of Russia. She does not come from the city. She comes from the outposts and was lost there and was raised by Totsky as a favor to her killed parents. But if we follow Aglaya, we have to follow the whole Yepanchin family. And they are a well-to-do family. They're the Cosbys. I mean, they're the sitcom family that's stable, and you like all of them. They all have their quirks. You learn their quirks because you want to see them in the next episode, you know, and so forth. They're good stock. Aglaya is the daughter. Aglaya is their prize. She is the one they want married well, and if she is married well, Russia will have a good future. Right? So there's a little slightly different drama there at work. The daughter who must be, you know, must be married well. Now there's not, she is herself not a bearer of a grand load of experience, but she is, well, I mean, I hope you all like her. She's a terrifically spunky character who really stands for spirit in the world. And we'll look for that in the future of Russia. And well, you know, again, by the end of the novel, very, very end of the novel, we find out what happens to Aglaya, and it's not a happy thing. You know? So, all right, I'm going to go ahead and say it. She's married off to a Polish count. A Polish count! And then, what's worse, they fall in with the Jesuits! Worst of all! Right, so, you know, and she breaks with her family. So it's really, in a sense, almost tragic what happens to every, you know, to most of the important, every important character in this novel. Dostoevsky was no friend of the Catholic Church or of the Poles.
So I gather.
So, think of that idea, right? This is a cosmic marriage that needs to happen, and instead it fails, right? That's why we have those strange scenes in which there's a sudden reversal, inverse marriage, right, where all is leading toward completion, and then whoop, you know, goes 180 degrees in the opposite direction. And the final scene, well, I won't spoil if you haven't read the final scene. Final scene is one of the greatest scenes in all of literature, and has been acknowledged as such, even by many critics who said that The Idiot is a failure as a novel. It is an amazing scene, but it should also remind you of a inverse wedding. Right, as one of the overtones of that final scene. It's meant, and the two bridegrooms are there with her, and it's all a scene of destruction. Right? So if we look at this with our archetypal glasses, you know, the Mother Earth of Russia does not meet her sky god. The sky god, without vigor, without eros, is not enough. Mishkin lacks what is needed for Russia. Rogozhin is not enough, obviously, although his vigor continues. He survives at the end of the novel and seems to have come to himself, so he will continue, but that's not any help for anyone. So, and if Mishkin embodies compassion and pity, Rogozhin embodies the opposite. A lust, a love, an eros that cannot be satisfied, that is pityless, right? And as he says at one point, there's no pity in my feeling for her, right? So there is no wholeness in this equation, in this novel. Okay, is that? No. That's. Now let's see. Think of, you know, the beautiful woman as an image of the health of a society, the society's sense of itself. Of course, we go back to Helen of Troy, right? We go back to Beatrice. Shakespeare has several candidates, and some are comic and live on, and some are tragic and die. Cordelia is one. So we have preface. We have a precedent for this. So, all right. Comments, questions? Let's hear some other questions from some of you who haven't spoken out yet. Anyone?
There was a question from last time I never answered involving Abbot Papnuti's handwriting. I forget. Did you ask that? Yeah.
Calligraphy.
Yeah, the calligraphy. And we might think about that for a moment. What does it mean that he says, well, you know, I can't do anything, but I'm good at imitating different styles of handwriting. Now, what does that tell you about Mishkin?
It wasn't me who asked that question.
But it's yeah.
Yeah, what's
quite striking. You get an early clue about Mishkin.
Because that occurs very early on when he's talking to General Function.
It's like the emasculation of artists, of an artist. That's that. The skill of artistry, the technical skill of artistry without the creative force.
what does it mean if you write, this is in Abbot Pafnuti's hand? And you can write it so that it looks exactly like that, but...
Uh-huh. Yeah, you can take it back to the simulacrum idea that, you know, he's got great form but no substance. There's mm-hmm. nothing he's actually saying, and it's not the good or the true or the beautiful that Michigan really propounds. It's some pale copy, you know, something like pity or soft soap that he gives.
Now take that forward to the Imitatio Christi, the imitation of Christ. You see? It's a very, very subtle indication early on in the novel that Michigan hasn't really quite penetrated to the heart of what's going on there. That he's good at taking, I think, you know, actually the Baudrillard's simulacre is exactly it. It's a simulacrum of what an original historical figure. There are two Abbot Pafnutis, by the way. An earlier one than a 15th century one, so it's not quite clear which one is meant here. And Leather Barrow has an interesting analysis of this, but I'm not myself entirely convinced that it's the... He says the first one is the one that's alluded to, but there's another one by the same name later, and he goes on to talk about him, and he says he's implied by both names. But it doesn't really matter, does it, in the end? That he finds this signature particularly well worth copying. He's not an abbot, he's a prince. And you have to wonder what's going on in this association.
And the whole debate about what is writing also then springs up in this. Is it a deadening of thought and the spoken word, or is it a spiritualization of language? Hegel thought the latter.
And it's interesting that Hippolyte has written out his his explanation, which he reads, mm-hmm. you notice,
mm-hmm.
and he has written it out with the idea of an audience, for sure. And there's the other irony that every ceremony, every gathering in this book is disrupted in some disastrous, catastrophic fashion. Even Mishkin's birthday party, you would think at least. Nothing seems to go right in these communal occasions, which means that the communal occasions don't exist anymore, really. That the riffraff can't be kept out.
Okay, so next class, we will have a short quiz on the final for the idiot also. I hope you will continue with these very fruitful mystifications, questions, and puzzlements, because I want you to talk. We will also look at a couple of key scenes in the novel. Some of those very kinds of scenes that Dr. Dupree was just talking about.
Stop the record. We're off the record now.
Thanks. That's good feeling.
You don't sound like a Fort Worth guy.
Hi, I emailed you about my Blackboard account because I'm not...
Right. I put you on.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. I did. I couldn't remember who had written it. I was looking around the room.
Well, I meant to ask all the graduate students, did you all get my message?
Yeah.
You didn't get a message? Some did, some didn't. John,
something
you better check
clicked.
Your email.
Uh-huh.
If there is so much contention between the Catholic and Orthodox churches,
mm-hmm.
which Dostoevsky brought into and agreed with, then towards the beginning of the Brothers Karamazov, when they're